Video computers online. Archiving 44K. Initiate sequence.
T minus 30 seconds.
Server connection confirmed.
T minus 25 seconds.
Live stream for 220K.
T minus 20 seconds.
Phone lines are go.
T minus 15 seconds.
Satellite uplink verified.
T minus 10 seconds.
Flight check complete. Satellite uplink verified.
5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
Welcome to Black Op Radio, the voice of political conspiracy research. You're listening to Black Op Radio, the show NSA doesn't want you to hear. Now here is your host, Leno Sanic.
Control room, you're on here.
Hello everyone and welcome to another episode of Black Op Radio. This is your host, Leno Sanic. Today we're speaking to author, researcher Chad Nagel. Hello, Chad.
Hi, Len. Good to talk to you again.
Thank you so much for making time for Black Op Radio and listeners. You've written several articles. Maybe just to start off, for people who are unfamiliar with your work, give us a brief background of your research, and then forward us to your Substack and things that you're working on. And I'm always happy to promote people doing good work in the research community.
Okay, well, thanks, Len. Yeah, I mean, we've spoken a couple of times before, and a lot seems to have happened, you know, since the last time. So I think the last time we spoke, the campaign was still going on, the presidential campaign, and I was with Bobby Kennedy Jr., and that was before he suspended his campaign and endorsed Trump. And obviously, a ton of stuff has happened with regard to the JFK assassination since then. So, you know, I'm a relative newbie when it comes to the researching. I plunged into the morbid historical mystery in the fall of 2017 after Trump's first postponement of the release of records. I read a ton of books, and then I got swept into kind of activism as I looked around, and I got attached to the Mary Farrell Foundation and ultimately JFK Facts, because Jeff Morley, who is editor-in-chief, is a vice president of the Mary Farrell Foundation. And I started writing about the legal issues around the lawsuit that the Mary Farrell Foundation filed against Biden and the National Archives. So that's how I started writing for JFK Facts, which is a relatively new Substack publication. I mean, it started off as a website, I think, in 2013. It was intended to be kind of a news site. So in other words, you know, we're dealing with a very cold case. So how do you do a news site that keeps people up to date on the latest stuff? It's not easy, but it translated well to Substack. I think it was in 2022, which was the year I attended my first JFK assassination conference in Dallas. That was a Kappa conference where I got to meet all these people who do some books I'd read, you know, Jim DiEugenio, and I got to meet, you know, David Mantic and Tink Thompson and people. And that was really exciting for me. You know, I mean, I think other people had seen all these other people a million times, but it was great because I was going into what JFK, he called Dallas, we're going into nut country. And I thought, well, I'm going to go into this place and it's going to be all these wacky people in addition to the people whose books I've read. But it wasn't like that at all. It was very civilized, very intelligent, very scholarly. So that was November 2022. And then in December 2022, the Mary Farrell Foundation formally announced its lawsuit at the National Press Club in D.C. And that's when I got to meet Jeff Morley, Rex Bradford, Larry Schnapp. Well, I had met Larry Schnapp at the Dallas conference, and Judge Thunheim was there. And so then at that point, you know, I felt, okay, well, look, I mean, I may be a newbie, but I can be involved in the activist part of this. I mean, legal activism, there's other kinds of activism. You can make documentaries, you can write books and stuff, but I wanted to be attached to that. So that's how I got attached to that. And already I started writing articles about JFK assassination, first for a publication called The American Conservative, which is a kind of right of center independent outlet, because they were receptive to JFK assassination points of view that dissented from the official the Warren Report, whatever official history. So they published like half a dozen pieces on different aspects of the from me, different aspects of the assassination, including the current lawsuit and the legislation, for example, like this congressman introduced a bill and then reintroduced it at the beginning of this year for release of records, David Schweikert, people don't remember. So I was following whatever there was in publishing, and then I started to talk to Jeff Morley about producing for JFK Facts. So by the spring of 2023, which was when I first talked to you, I was actually in Japan at that point. I wrote my first article about the CIA's transparency plans, which they tried to impose to basically supersede and permanently replace the JFK Records Act of 1992. And when I hear people say, Trump was bad in the first disclosure, but Biden was maybe worse, and I'm like, he wasn't maybe worse. It was like on this issue, he was far worse. I mean, they were going to completely bury the whole legal regime that governed declassification of JFK assassination related records, and they almost succeeded. If Trump's executive order of 2025 and then this Luna task force the following month, if that hadn't happened, we might still be languishing under those transparency plans. So the legal fight is still on in some issues. That case is still in federal court, and Mary Farrell Foundation is it's represented by Bill Simpich and Larry Schnapp, and there are still some issues that they have to settle with the National Archives. But this whole thing that happened this year has really taken a lot of the wind out of the CIA's sails. So, but already, even when I started writing, I mean, there was really a lot to write about even before this. And I got very into it sort of late. I did a deep dive, like 12-part series on the destruction of JFK records from 1963 to 1995, called Trail of Destruction. So, 12 instances of federal agencies destroying or presumptively destroying records. I mean, I want to make the point that in most formal destructions, they issue a destruction order. You can actually get the record. But there's a lot of cases where it's just presumed destroyed, like the LBJ Hoover phone call. The LBJ Library has the tape of those two talking on the morning after the assassination, right? 23rd of November, Saturday, 1963. And it's supposed to be 15 minutes long, and the transcript is only, I don't know, I think it's a couple of pages. I can't remember, but it's definitely not 15 minutes of conversation. So I think those two talked about a lot more. There was obviously the autopsy notes. They're destroyed, for sure. There are some instances of destruction where the agency, like Army Intelligence or Defense Intelligence Agency, or even the CIA, has a destruction order. Like they gave a destruction, they said, well, this is a routine destruction, and we had to destroy these things. But there are other cases where, like the Air Force One tape, I mean, first of all, the LBJ Library produced a copy of this thing, and it was full of redactions. And then in 2011, I think it was called, somebody put up for auction a version that had a lot of stuff that was not on the original LBJ Library version, which mean and it told us that there was a discussion about how the body was going to go from Andrews Air Force Base, JFK's body, and it was sort of agreed that it was going to be choppered from Andrews Air Force Base to Bethesda. I mean, that's on the tape, you can hear it. It was choppered. Well, we're all told that it came in that hearse that we see pulling up in front. So that's very interesting, and that leads to the question, if somebody produced a less redacted version that also includes like where was Curtis LeMay, type of discussion of that kind as well. If somebody produced a less redacted version, does the fully unredacted version exist somewhere? Where might that be? Where does the National Archives really have, records that are not paper but are film and recordings and tapes, somewhere buried down there, like the Zapruder film, the Orville Nix film? Can we find them? I mean, it would be really something to have the originals of these things. So anyway, so that was a fascinating project, to write about, the the destruction or presumed destruction of records, because we don't want to go on a fishing expedition. When we make requests to Congress, to this task force on declassification that Representative Luna heads, we don't want to say, look, we don't know if it exists, but it might. Can we go looking for it? Because they won't know what to do, and even the agencies won't. So what we've focused on is documents that we know exist and that were never turned over to the archives in the 1990s, and which, we know we can get if the CIA or the FBI just, agrees to turn them over. And so as far as JFK facts goes, which has been most of my writing, I've written like over 90 articles since April of 2023, and most of them involve some in-depth research on some different aspect of the assassination. And that's over, well, I guess it's more than a couple of months, a month. I haven't done the math, but most of it's involved some serious research. We had a really cool countdown series in November of 2023, which was the month where they had that wonderful conference in Pittsburgh, the last that I think Cyril Wecht was able to attend. I mean, it was just a phenomenal conference. I mean, everyone was there, and either in person or by Zoom. And we did a countdown series almost every day of November 2023. And we said, what happened on this day in 1963? And we went all the way to the end of the month. So we covered the murder of Oswald, the formation of the Warren Commission, and this obvious stitch up that was going on with the FBI and the DOJ, where they've already decided that, it's a lone gunman. And then we ended it with Robert Kennedy and Jackie Kennedy expressing their view that this lone nut thing was not what happened. So that was a lot of fun. And this was all done kind of obviously before the big declassification. And so when JFK Facts puts out, an appeal either on the podcast or on the, on the website for people to submit work based on research of the new records, because I mean, tens of thousands, 77 or 80,000 new pages that are completely unredacted. There's stuff in there that nobody's written about, and there's stuff, and there are people that will respond and say, I don't want to waste my time reinventing the wheel if other people have done stuff, and they shouldn't bother probably even doing JFK research. It's not the right attitude. I've hit so many dead ends in the past, what, like, since I started going to the archives a lot, which is like in the past couple of years, and you learn not to mind. It's you're always learning something, and it's really interesting. So I think I'd like to just give an example of something that I, an example of how I hit a dead end, but it was still really interesting. In summer of 2023, okay, so by this time we've had quite a few declassifications, not the full ones, but things were coming out. And you may remember the Biden administration. Biden issued his executive order in at the end of June of 2023, and he that executive order said, "This is my final declassification under the Act." Okay, and he did it late on a Friday night. I mean, someone wrote it for him. Obviously, he wasn't doing it himself, but. So, in other words, I don't have any more responsibility under the JFK Records Act. This is it. And we already knew that there were still lots and lots of stuff that hadn't been released. But he did that after a significant declassification earlier in the month. In fact, I think it might have even only been like a week earlier. I don't remember. So up to that point, we'd gotten a lot of interesting stuff. And in December of 2022, a document revealed the identity of someone named Ramon Joseph Alvarez Durant, known as Ramon Alvarez for short. And he was revealed as the Mexican CIA agent with the cryptonym Lie-Empty-1 and pseudonym Raymond Gerend, who was very, very important to the CIA, and he supervised the whole team of Mexican photographic surveillance agents around the Soviet embassy in Mexico City for the CIA under the program called Lie-Empty. And this Lie-Empty program, so all of the agents had a cryptonym that was Lie-Empty followed by a number, and it went up to like 28 or something. It was really a lot of people. And there was the number two guy was another man, Juan Nepomuceno Frias Ramirez, pseudonym Oliver Scantling. So, but until March 2025, the document that I got excited about had one redaction left, and it covered the name of the agent with the cryptonym LIMT6. And the relevant passage in the little memo said, "In 1963, when Oswald allegedly visited the Soviet embassy, Scantling, that's LIMT2, was the PA for the limited base house, and LIMT6, followed by long redaction, under which is his real name, was the photo tech who took the pictures." Well, I got really excited about this. I contacted Jeff Morley and I said, "Look, there's this document, it's one redaction left, and that's the guy who took the pictures of Lee Harvey Oswald." And Jeff was like, "Well, that is interesting. Why don't you go and check it out and look into it?" So while I was homing in on the identity of LIMT6, I spent a lot of time at the archives trying to find the write-up of Ed Lopez. So Ed, the HSCA investigator, when he interviewed Ramon Alvarez in Mexico City, I think it was in August of 1978. Now, this write-up, which is in his handwriting, which is very small and distinctive, is actually available online, but I couldn't find it. I couldn't find it because the metadata didn't, whatever, whenever I searched for it, it didn't come up. There wasn't the right things on the cover sheet and so forth. So I spent a long time in the archives going through boxes, and I finally found it. I found the hard copy, the original paper. It's quite something when you hold the actual original paper from the 1970s with the handwriting on it. And when I brought it to Jeff Morley's attention, and Margot Williams is our research director and his partner, she started to track down Ramon Alvarez's surviving relatives, because he was dead, and his wife was also dead. She was, by the way, also a surveillance agent for the LIMT operation. She was a Dutch woman named Hester Roos, and she had the CIA cryptonym LIMT19. But they found sons and daughters who told us all about them and how they found out that their parents once worked for the CIA. And it turned out this guy, Ramon Alvarez, had actually even been in some Hollywood movies with like these cameo appearances as some sort of spy, and they sent us pictures of them and so forth. And it was kind of interesting, but it ultimately was kind of a dead end because they didn't know who LIMT6 was, first of all. And then the second dead end that I ran into was I found out that LIMT6, despite what it said in the CIA document, probably hadn't photographed Oswald, assuming Oswald was there because it was the wrong base house. So the two CIA base houses that targeted the entrance of the Soviet embassy for the CIA were called Limited and Lilyric. So everything in Mexico City for the CIA began with LI. That was like the prefix on the cryptonyms. And the timestamps for the limited base house, which is where Lamptey 6 was located, this mystery man, the time log, the log en ended before, I think it ended at like 11:46 a.m. or something. And Oswald was supposed to have visited at 12:30 p.m., right? And so the HSCA had actually tried to locate the Lilyric, which is the other base house, their photo log, which had timestamps. In other words, it says the date and time of each photo taken. It doesn't say what it's of, but it logs the times. And they couldn't get it. And this led to the suspicion that if anybody photographed Oswald, it was from the Lilyric base house, not Limited. And so so it would have been a Mexican CIA surveillance agent with the cryptonym LIMT14 who would have taken the pictures of Oswald, and that set us off on yet another journey to find the identity of a Mexican CIA agent. Okay, and because of us, and this is one of the reasons why people should never just dismiss going to the archives and doing research and trying to find stuff out, because what happened was the CIA slipped up in their documentation. They accidentally revealed the surname. Well, they revealed the first name and the surname of the head of the household in that base house, Lilyric. And what the CIA used to do was they used to employ families as their surveillance agents in these base houses. And the reason they did it was for security, because if any of these Mexicans started to talk about their work, which they were told they couldn't talk about with anybody, they'd most likely talk to their family members, and their family members would know that they each were spies. And in this base house, the husband was Lyamty 13, the wife was Lyamty 14, and the two sons were Lyamty 26 and 27. Okay, and they were like students, like at an institute. I think they were like 17 and 18 years old, and all of them worked in support of this CIA surveillance operation of the Soviet embassy. And it was the same in the other base houses. They had families of three or four people, and they all had cryptonyms, among these. So, three base houses around the embassy itself, and one roving van. And then you had the supervisors, and altogether it was, I don't know, it was like two dozen at least of these agents. Now, it turned out that Lyamty 14 was the mother, and she was described by Ann Goodpaster, who was sort of the chief assistant to the CIA's chief of station in Mexico City, as in a document on the history of the CIA in Mexico City, as the star photographer of the whole operation. All of her pictures were clear. She never missed anything. She was just amazing, and she was not, she was not ever identified by name. But because of this CIA slip up in an administrative document where they named the people who are the residents of each apartment on each floor, Margot Williams was able to track down a relative. And it turned out it was only one out of the four was still alive. Lyamty 26 was a man in his 70s, I guess, late 70s, retired auto dealer living in the suburbs of Seattle, now a US citizen. And they found him, and they contacted him, and asked him if he wanted to talk. And he said, "Yeah, I've always wanted to talk about this." And he said, "My mother had a photographic memory. She wasn't a formally highly educated woman. She died in 2008. She might not have even finished high school, but she was a great photographer, and she was really intelligent and had a photographic memory. And she swore until she died that she had gotten a photograph of Lee Harvey Oswald coming and going." Now, what's interesting about this, of course, is that she would have never seen the prints of her photos. These photographic agents, these Mexican agents who took pictures, they would give rolls of film to the CIA courier, and the CIA courier would deliver it to the station where it would be developed, and that was it, you know. But she said, after the assassination, "I got that guy's picture," and she knew that they were denying that they'd ever photographed him, right? That was the official CIA line from David Attlee Phillips and all these others. No, he wasn't there, and or we missed him or whatever, and he wasn't on our radar. Well, of course, he was on their radar very much, and so we don't know whether she actually photographed him or she photographed someone who bore an uncanny resemblance to him and was impersonating him. But in any case, I thought this was a great story. But what was interesting and very educational for me was that, mainstream media did not, pay any attention to this story at all. I mean, I thought, well, this is amazing. And the CIA has always denied it. And here we have, admittedly, hearsay, because, the son is saying what his mother said. But, there's actually a legal exception to the hearsay rule if it comes from someone who was, A, both working with on the same, doing the same work in the same operation as the person they're quoting, and is also like an immediate family relative. So a high level of credibility, and I don't see any reason why he would have any reason to lie. I mean, after all, if he was going for attention, he'd probably say the opposite, right? No, she said she didn't get a picture, but she apparently always said she did. But the mainstream media paid no attention. In fact, no media really picked it up. And so that was a first big rude awakening for me, that however deep I go into these things, you step back and the rest of the world is just not paying any attention at all. But anyway, as we moved into late, I guess like into 2024, there was more stuff on the legal front, and I kept writing about that. And then Jeff Morley broke an interesting story about a CIA whistleblower, and that was picked up by at least some media, lower level, like the Hill's Rising program, Breaking Points, not, CNN and the New York Times, but, other things. And it was very interesting. A CIA contract employee who still doesn't want to reveal his identity said he was working for the CIA in years ago, and he found in a couple of they're called SCIFs. I think it stands for Secure Compartmented Information Facility, somewhere in Virginia. One was in Herndon and one was somewhere else. He found materials related to the assassination, including a like it would have been like a VHS tape in the case. It was in a case, and the case read Oswald in Mexico or Oswald in Mexico City, something like that. And he contacted Jeff and said, "I don't want to come forward with this because this stuff was never turned over to to anybody. It was never turned over to the archives. It's obviously assassination related." And one of the things he saw was a CIA Inspector General's report on how the agency should deal with Congress in the event of an investigation. And I think it was like a kind of lessons learned format, drawing on the HSCA experience, where clearly Congress was stonewalled and deceived. And unfortunately, he still hasn't decided to come forward, even after these congressional hearings that we've had. But that was an interesting story, and I drove out to the facility and took photographs for the article, and then I got chased by some guys in an SUV who were like in they were dressed in their full cami fatigues with flak vests, and one of them even had a machine gun, and they were super friendly. They kind of got out of their car when I went to the next neighboring building and parked, and they wanted to know what I was doing, and I told them. I told them the story, and they were like, "Oh, that's okay, it's fine." But I had gone in and taken a picture of the front entrance and then driven off, and before I knew it, I was getting followed. So it's kind of funny. But this is the kind of thing that you kind of have to do, I think. I mean, I like all the analytical writing. I love all the sort of deep dive research, but we want to try to keep it alive, and it is a live issue now. I mean, it's not a top headline, but it's definitely a headline. And so the obviously the near the end of 2024, we saw the 60th anniversary of the Warren Report, and JFK Facts did a series on that. And I did a couple of pieces, one about Victoria Adams and the women in the Texas School Book Depository who were ignored by the Warren Commission, David Bellin. And I did another one on Oswald's paraffin tests and the Warren Commission bearing evidence that he hadn't fired a rifle that was based on nitrates found on the paraffin casts. This highly precise neutron activation analysis that was done at the Oak Ridge Atomic Laboratory. That's mentioned in the Warren Report, but it's kind of buried and it's given no serious attention or credibility. And even though there was a Warren Commission attorney, Norman Redlich, who cautioned the commission members, I think Alan Dulles, that there was no evidence that Oswald had even fired a rifle on the day. So they didn't want to put that in there. And then as time moved on, I got increasingly attached to this Cuban exile named Herminio Diaz Garcia, who was identified as a participant in the JFK assassination to Anthony Summers, I think in 2013, a Cuban exile who was then living in Miami and quite old and not given long to live, told him that he'd had that story that he wanted to get off his chest, and that when he first came to America in 19, I think 80, he came forward and tried to tell people and was just told that the investigation was over. And I wrote a piece as Kash Patel was being bandied about as the FBI director. I said, I wrote a piece saying, if you're confirmed as director, this guy's 201 files of interest, and that's going to be in the CIA's possession, but the FBI also has a bunch of stuff about him. And so I've written now a few pieces on Herminio Diaz, and his 201 file is among the documents that has been requested by for the Luna Task Force. And It's successfully. I mean, they've managed to secure it. It hasn't published yet, but it will be. These things kind of are get bogged down, I think, in bureaucracy. And plus, the CIA and other agencies slipped up with the release of the Social Security numbers. You know, this became a snafu and a kind of scandal. And because of it, the first hearing in which Oliver Stone testified with Jim DiEugenio and Jeff Morley had that guy that the Democrats brought along to say, "Look, what a disaster it is." You know, that was what the Democrats did. I mean, that's, you know, thanks a lot. You know, I know. So anyway, that slowed things down. But you know, tons of stuff to write about the new files that have been released. I was also fortunate to be brought along to the archives when the Luna Task Force in April secured our access. So Jeff Morley and Margo Williams and I went to the archives to look at. You might remember that the FBI announced that it had located 2,400 files related to the assassination that had never been made public. And they invited us to go and look at these boxes. And it there weren't any smoking guns in there. And in fact, these boxes were related to these files were related to something called the FBI JFK Task Force that was formed in the early 90s as the FBI was gearing up to comply with the JFK Records Act. So the Assassination Records Review Board had not yet been formed, and there was a little window in there where they started to collect the documents that they had. So a lot of these things were those documents. But what was interesting was I found all these documents with handwritten marginalia on them, like stuff written by, you know, in the margins by FBI agents and stamps that relate and, you know, things, notes saying we have to refer this to CIA before we can declassify it. I mean, I thought that was like, well, really? I mean, so you're a separate agency, but you have to ask their permission, of course, if you want to declassify something. So I thought that was interesting. And we wrote some stuff on that, on those things. And then I got in April, late April, I got a tip from David Boylan, who wrote a book recently called The Oswald Puzzle. He co-authored it with Larry Hancock. And he said that this Herminio Diaz fellow, this Cuban exile that I was kind of obsessed with, he had a document, he had found it online that was an FBI informant's report about him, about Herminio Diaz. And the informant was a highly credible Cuban exile guy who had been in a previous government before Castro and was now associated with a former, I think, prime minister or president before Castro. And he said, there's only the first page, there's only a cover page. It says, you know, what it's about. And there's supposed to be the write-up attached to it, like 2 pages about Herminio Diaz based on what this guy was prepared to say. And see if you can go find it. So I went down there and I found it. And there's a couple of pages in there with the page that he had that was online. Because you can see on the cover page how many pages there are supposed to be. If it says 3 and there's only one apart from the cover page, there's 2 missing. And in this case, it was obvious. Well, on the first page, there was like a one sentence paragraph after the first paragraph that says Herminio Diaz Garcia is or was working for the CIA. This was 4 days after the assassination, November 26th. This document did not go, I mean, I've never seen it. It was not online. So, of course, I scanned it and then I wrote an article about it. I said, I mean, I don't know what this means because he doesn't go into detail. This guy was a hoodlum, he was an assassin. He had actually been done for murder. He'd murdered someone in Mexico City by his own admission to the CIA. He left and immigrated to the United States in July of 1963. In September of 1963, he's debriefed by the CIA, no problem, even though he's a murderer. I mean, this guy's like a professional hitman assassin, worked for Meyer Lansky in his Havana hotel casino, right? The Hotel Riviera. worked as a bodyguard for Santo Trafficante and claimed to have sprung him out of jail in Cuba, because Santo Trafficante was thrown in jail by the Cuban government for, I think, attempted bribery. And this guy was like a real heavy. In fact, he'd used to be in a long time before he had been in a gang with Fidel Castro. But, I think he felt like, maybe he'd lost out, And so, I mean, I thought this was kind of, a bombshell. But again, I mean, it's not something that mainstream media is gonna pick up. And then we had the hearings. Basically, we had two hearings, April and May, which I thought were, I mean, I thought that, I mean, I'm sure you've watched them, but the first hearing with Oliver Stone, that was covered by not just C-SPAN, which has is it, that's what C-SPAN's supposed to do. It's supposed to cover congressional hearings, but also a bunch of other outlets. And legacy media even interviewed the witnesses like Oliver Stone, Jim DeGeni. They appeared like on Fox News and some other segments, and it was covered. It was sensational. And then the next hearing, which was May 20th, in my opinion, was actually even more sensational for what it, what it told the public and what it put on the congressional record. And that was the key. It's not that we didn't, as JFK assassination researchers, that we weren't already aware of the findings and the statements of the people who were appearing. It's that it had never been in the congressional record before. I mean, there's a stenographer there and and recording devices, the whole thing's being recorded, and this is forever for posterity. And it was great to see Dan Hardway, John Thunheim, a Parkland doctor, former Parkland doctor who'd been in trauma room one and seen JFK's head wounds, and Doug Horne, whose research is very familiar to us all. But again, he'd never testified under oath to Congress. I mean, it was a big deal. But this time, it was completely, even C-SPAN didn't broadcast. I mean, that's their job. They're supposed to record and broadcast these hearings on their channel, supposed to make them available on one of their several channels. They ignored it. Mainstream media ignored it. And only Forbes Breaking News, which is a tier two outlet, put it on their YouTube channel. If it wasn't for Forbes Breaking News, we wouldn't have these hearings. So that was, it was kind of cool. And of course, again, it was disappointing and it was demoralizing, but after all, it is in the congressional record, and that's pretty great. I started, but it was actually before the big disclosure that happened in June, first by Axios and then by the Washington Post on the front page about this George Ioannidis personnel file. And before that was released, I started a series on JFK in the movies, Echoes of Dallas. So it was kind of incongruous by the time, by the time the big news hit, I was doing this thing that, was on, but I'm still quite proud of it. It's a 6-part series. It started on June 7th, and the last episode was on July 12th. But if you look at the way the JFK assassination has been treated in the movies and Hollywood, it ends, there's a zenith in the mid-90s, right? Because Oliver Stone released Nixon, and it had that great scene with Nixon and Helms in Langley talking. And that was cut out of the theatrical release because Helms threatened to sue. And but it was released for home video. So when the home video came out, I think the following year, it had that scene in it. But after that, in 1996, the year after that movie was released, that was when the CIA started its entertainment industry liaison officer program. And what you find after that is just, well, if there's a reference to JFK assassination, it certainly doesn't cast aspersions on any federal government agencies, CIA and so forth. Forget it. That's finished. They make sure, because anybody who wants to do a movie about the CIA is going to need, they want CIA help. And they only get it if they portray the CIA a certain way. They can have CIA villains, but they can't blame them for the assassination of a president. That's out. So that was kind of an interesting thing for me to learn about the history of JFK in Hollywood. And I mean, that doesn't bring me quite up to the present day. I don't know whether you heard, but Luna appeared on
Joe Rogan.
you. Yeah, she appeared on Joe Rogan, and she did actually talk about this on Joe Rogan. But before that, she'd been on Chris Cuomo's News Nation, and she broke the story that she'd gone to the Russian embassy and spoken to the Russian ambassador, and they'd agreed to release the KGB files on Oswald. And I wrote a piece for JFK Facts called Oswald's Other KGB File, the Mexico City Report. And that was in the wake of the George Joannides file, which we can talk about, I think, for at least a few minutes. I want to devote to it, but I'll just say that the Russians are talking about their KGB surveillance files on the two on Oswald when he was in the Soviet Union for 2.5 years. Very interesting to historians. No one has seen them. They said they turned them over to the CIA and they just disappeared. It's like they were trying to help the Soviets, but there's also the file from Mexico City, because those KGB officers in the Soviet embassy said that they sent a report to Moscow immediately after his visit. This was published in this guy's book, Passport to Assassination, right? He published this thing, and he published lots of Soviet documents in there, but he didn't publish that report. And I'm doubtful that he ever wrote it. And so I actually said to Luna when I was in her office once, I said, if you're going to go and meet with the Russian ambassador, then please bring that up, because it's dated September, it should be dated September 28th, 1963. They said they sent it to Moscow, and they described this whole encounter with Oswald. Remember waving the gun around in the embassy? I've always doubted that was true. So I wrote a thing about that, and then I did my own deep dive, 6-part, conspiracy theorizing, which is not allowed on JFK Facts, about that whole episode, which your listeners might, some of them might be interested in reading about. And then recently there's been a piece I co-authored with Bill Simpich about Oswald's half-hour phone call on the night of the 23rd, the night before he was killed, which nobody's ever established who he talked to or what he talked about, because nobody ever came forward and said, yeah, we talked to him. Nobody. And we speculated, and I think it's very credible, that he spoke to an FBI informant at the New York City office of The Worker, which was the main publication and organ of the Communist Party USA. And the reason that we don't know is, and the FBI didn't care, was because he talked to one of their people. And so that's kind of an interesting story. And that calls for more declassification. What are the identities of the FBI informants that had contact with Oswald, who were in the Communist Party and who had contact with Oswald, when he was calling from jail? And then the most recent thing I did was Hoover's Warren Commission testimony was altered. And this is, remember, he testified under oath to the Warren Commission, and someone came in and changed his testimony. And it, instead of reading that, he said the back of President Kennedy's skull was practically shot off. They changed it to the back of portions of. I mean, that's a significant change, and it obviously is because they needed it to conform it to the lone gunman thing. But that's really sinister. And of course, Hoover himself, he didn't care. He went along with everything. But there were other people who said that their testimony had been altered, such as Victoria Adams and Roger Craig, and they did not approve. So that's basically where we are. And I just, the big story that came out in June and was published first on Axios and then in the Washington Post. I mean, I've heard that belittled, and I've heard it sort of not exactly dismissed, but kind of it's kind of belittled or trivialized as a news item by certain people in the assassination research community. They'll remain nameless, there's no point. But what I've heard is that they say this is not what we should be focusing on. We should be focusing on, the role of Alan Dulles or something like that, because we know that Joannides was Howard and so forth. And it's like, well, you say you know, but now we've proven it beyond a doubt, beyond a reasonable doubt that, and now it may take a while, but the historical record, so American historiography, the way we treat our own history has to change. Now, it's not going to change overnight because it takes a while for these things to resonate. But we know now that that aspect of the Warren report and what the CIA always told, and the FBI as well, but the CIA primarily told the Warren Commission, including under oath and Congress, Angleton to the HSCA and also George Joannides as liaison, that they just didn't really know who Oswald was. He came out of nowhere and he was an unknown quantity. And yeah, he interacted with these Cuban exiles who were under the CIA's AMSPEL program, because he wandered along. He was some random guy, and he was a leftist, hoodlum or a leftist kind of extremist sort of I don't know, rabble rousing, agitating fool. And that's not true. This was part of an operation, a part of a propaganda operation, and Oswald got roped in. How did he end up being the patsy? Well, that's a very good question. But he clearly was the fall guy, and he was not some lone nut. And so I think that is a major story. And we have to be patient because the process is still going on. It's still going on, and there are going to be more documents released. But after all this time, I think people probably have to manage their expectations about what we can get from official documentation. So that's what I would say. I'm sorry, I have really just blathered on here. I'm scrolling through my own Substack feed as I look at all the things I've done and basically trying to summarize it. But that's kind of my view. And there've been other things too. There've been other really interesting things that have been released, like the Somehow the FBI's recordings of Marina Oswald. There was a summary report written of the wiretapping, extensive wiretapping of Marina Oswald's house over 2 weeks in 1964. So while the Warren Commission was meeting, the Warren Commission asked the FBI if they would wiretap her house. So they recorded everything. I mean, they recorded her talking about like sex with girlfriends and stuff on the phone. I mean, really, pretty bad. But we never heard the actual recordings, and of course, it's in Russian. But I actually understand Russian, so I was able to listen to it and fill in some things. And it's very interesting to listen to the questions that she had about Oswald's guilt, because he was already, he was dead, and he was already identified as the patsy. And she talks about this bag, that had the rifle in it, right? The paper bag. She said, where did that come from? He didn't arrive with it, and he didn't it wasn't in the house. So how did he bring it to, how did he leave with it? And I thought that was kind of interesting, and somebody brought that to my attention, and I wrote it up. And so going forward, we've got certain things to look forward to, I guess. I mean, I think that the KGB files will be revelatory. I think we'll find out some things about Oswald's life, about what he did. I still think the book written by Ernst Titovets, Oswald Russian Episode, is one of the best books out there for getting a picture of the real Lee Harvey Oswald, who I don't think was a violently homicidal person. I don't think he was homicidal at all. But there's going to be more things filled in, hopefully. Not everything, but so that's it. And I suppose I would just, I would thank you for giving me time to shrink my head on your show.
Right, no problem at all. And I'll ask you maybe to send me some of the links of those things that you did discuss in that, and we'll put them in the show notes.
Yeah, happy to do
And
that.
yeah,
Happy.
good, good. Thank you
I'm
so
happy to
much for
do that.
that. Right.
Yeah,
Now,
and I
the
mean,
only thing, I had a comment here, and I didn't want to interrupt, but you're going. You mentioned that a couple of the articles around the Joe Needy's time, when they were saying, well, we already knew that, and but it's time to focus on the bigger picture. I somewhat agree with that, to the point that if you stand back and you look at the bullet, and like the paraffin test and this and that, you go, well, he didn't shoot, then the study to the nth degree of Lee Oswald only just reaffirms that he didn't do it. And at some point we'll say, okay, now back to the people who ordered it. And I think in the movie Nixon, you mentioned that they're sitting around a room where they're kind of talking to Nixon, and they say, listen, would you be our guy? Like, what if something happened to Kennedy? Would you be ready? And then he kind of says, well, no, there'll be Bobby Kennedy, it'll be Ted, there'll be whatever, No, it's nothing's going to happen, right? And then
Right.
after Kennedy shot, you see him kind of reflecting. I forget where he was, but I think he pulled his car over, and he's thinking, maybe those guys are asking me if I'd be the guy, Otherwise,
Yeah.
they went with Lyndon Johnson. And
Right.
that does interest me, but I'm not going to say I'm jaded, but I've been doing Black Op Radio for over 26 years. So my interest before that, right? It's more like, yeah, at some point we have to just stand back and say the CIA has been lying, everybody's been covering up. I mean, nothing's more obvious than these Epstein Island things, like now Trump says there is no list. What are you guys even studying that for? Right?
Yeah.
Back to the point where the guy was saying, well, we know Joe Anides was in there, but what do why do you guys even surprise? It just really underscores how crooked and worse than you thought things are,
Yeah. Well, yeah, and actually what you just highlighted, I think, is at the crux of the issue of what I always refer to as the public trust. I mean, I certainly adhere to the idea that President Kennedy's assassination was a coordinated, pre-planned operation. And as far as Oswald goes, I also am of the opinion, and by the way, no two people who dissent from the official version agree on everything, no matter how closely they work together, because we don't have a Bible. We don't have the Warren Report. We can't just fall back on that. We're going to reach our own conclusions. But what I think, is very, very important about the most recent news discovery is that at the level of public trust, I would say the CIA, but let's just say the national security and intelligence apparatus. I mean, they're faced with a choice. They don't want to look at it because it's something old and they've got current day things to think about. So they're not going to go back into this cold case. But this old cold case is hugely important because what's happened is this, let's say the CIA is faced with a choice we call Hobson's choice right now in terms of the public trust and its image in society. One is that they can continue to cling to the Warren Report, which is increasingly discredited, because as things come out, it's obvious that nonsense about he was a lone nut and he was a sociopath loner, he came out of nowhere, and gee, he took the whole world by surprise. That is nonsense. That is nonsense. They had a nearly 200-page dossier on this guy sitting, even if not on James Angleton's desk, and certainly in his department, for years. I mean, this thing was building up and building up right until the time of the assassination. They're watching him very closely. Okay. So they can either say now, all right, I think clinging to the Warren Report is a bad option. They may do it because our governments are very stupid. But they can either say, yeah, in the wake of the assassination, at the very height of the Cold War, we really were afraid that there was a conspiracy. And then this guy was shot to death, so he was already dead. So yes, it was a stitch up, right? They could do that. That would be one way of throwing the Warren Commission under the bus. And they would have to admit, of course, to a massive intelligence failure. And they could say, and they in that case, they could still say Oswald did it, which we don't believe. They might go with that. The other option is to say, yeah, he didn't do it. And he was actually somebody that we were using, at least very minimally in a peripheral way, for a propaganda and psychological warfare operation. And he was one of our, subjects, but he didn't do it. In which case, what it looks like is, yeah, somebody set him up, and it was people in, in this national security establishment. Some people knew about it. I mean, I have my own top suspects in CIA. I've never discounted that that organized crime played a role, and they certainly played a role in the cover up, I think, and the execution of the most important witness. But the intersection between the CIA and organized crime is really the Cuban exiles, because these guys worked as hitmen. They were really good with guns. Some of them were Bay of Pigs veterans. They were angry. They hated Kennedy. So it's not a mutually exclusive thing. I mean, yes, you could situate it in a an office in the Pentagon, or buried deep beneath in Dr. Strangelove scenario where these guys are mapping it out. Yeah, you could do that too. I mean, I don't know. I don't know, but I think the most that we can do is chip away at this ridiculous, discredited edifice as much as we can with factual revelations. I mean, that's really why I gravitated to JFK facts, as I said in the beginning, was to identify where the activism was that I thought I could participate in, and get new facts, by which I mean not, new things that could be ascertained, that could be established as fact, as opposed to based on a very strong and reasonable suspicion. In other words,
Well,
yeah.
I'm going to disagree with you there. I have met several, I mean, just many people who are not in the JFK research community that have followed this and they're right on to it, right? Yeah, like they'll say, I've always wanted to know more about Alan Dulles and his role and John Foster Dulles and from 1947 on, the creation of the CIA. I want to know where that money came from. And right then and there, they pinpoint, you don't have to argue with the couple of hundred people that is that also in the doorway? Or is that, what's his name, Lovelady? You know what I mean? Like once you get into the research community, the people kind of start to argue amongst themselves about what's the right thing. And other people who are not into it, that occasionally just listen to my show and write in, they say that, they appreciate just a more global view that,
Right.
like, I think, what did you just say? You just said the most we can do was looking into Lee Oswald and that. And I'm just paraphrasing, but, the other side of the coin is we could stand back further. And, I think at the end of the movie JFK, they say, okay, it's up to you to start looking into this. But if you recognize that what the Warren Commission did in blaming a lone assassin is all fraud, then the question should be like, well, we got to learn, who ordered this and how did they get away with it to keep it from happening again?
That would be the Holy Grail, wouldn't it? I mean, if we could do that, I'm just,
Well, look at
I
this guy.
suppose.
What is his name? Crux in the shot at Trump? There's
Right.
nothing. They've learned their lesson. There's no congressional hearings. There's no
Right.
investigation of that. They said he did it and that was it. And
I
they
know. I know.
cleaned his
Yeah.
house.
I know.
Game
It's
over.
horrible. It is. It's terrible. I mean, I wrote a piece on that, by the way, that said this was Warren Report Redux, was the conclusion of that task force that looked into that assassination attempt, or whatever the hell that thing was. It was really shoddy and really unimpressive and not credible. And it's just a symptom of this tradition, I mean, the Warren Commission is in a tradition. I mean, we had a 9/11 commission. We've had all kinds of, we had the January 6th committee. I think it was very inadequate. I mean, we had all kinds of all things, and the Warren Commission is kind of the progenitor, I suppose, of it all. I mean, why do we have a problem saying, look, we may never know exactly who plotted and orchestrated, for certain. We may never be able to prove it. But what we can definitely do is debunk and discredit the official version. And then we're on a, because I've always said, we're better off admitting as a nation that we don't know what happened, but accepting that it was some kind of conspiracy, than carrying along with that with that farce. Why is the assassination of President Lincoln universally accepted as having been the result of a conspiracy, even though they didn't catch all the conspirators, right? They hanged some people, but they didn't get everybody. Why is that okay? And what makes JFK so special that he has to be the victim of a lone nut? And we can't admit that obviously there's some kind of conspiracy behind it. I mean, come on. And, you know, I don't have a problem with saying that, because if you, you know, if you dissent from the Warren Report, you say this lone nut thing is a bunch of rubbish. So what's the next step? And that's why I end up going back. I've ended up falling back on Oswald by saying, you know, this lone nut thing is absurd. And so let's just chip away at that, and then
yeah, and here's the reasons
we stand
why.
Back and say, yeah, I mean, if we stand back and say, look, this was organized at the highest levels of the Pentagon, and Alan Dulles facilitated and all the rest of it, I mean, we can't prove it. We just can't. And, you know, I'm not going to indulge that too much. I mean, if I write a novel or make a movie one day, it would be great. I'd love to dramatize it, but, you know, these facts, like, you remember the usual suspects came out to attack the finding of the implications of the George Ioannidis file, right? So we now know this guy was for sure Howard. He was definitely supervising the Cuban exiles under AMSPEL. They definitely came into contact with Lee Harvey Oswald, and then he was assigned illegally by the CIA to be the liaison to Stonewall and divert them. Well, look, even if that's all we could ascertain as of now, we know there was a cover-up. So what are they covering up? I mean, to me, that's it. You just keep kicking up the cover-up, as it were.
And he was given a medal. He was given a medal.
One of the most prestigious medals that the CIA has to offer, and they gave it to him in a secret ceremony and didn't release the photo of it until, I don't know when it was, in the 2000s sometime. And they gave it to him in 1981, I think, or something. So it was like right after he'd done his dirty work for Congress, they gave him a medal for it. And it's there. It's one of the citations in the document that we got released. They said that's for his assignment. That's for his performances doing that. And they knew exactly who he was and why he was sent there. And why they stuck him in there in 1978 when Dan Hardway and Ed Lopez were making all these discoveries. You know, for me, it was very exciting to watch those guys testify. And, you know, it wasn't well attended. The only Democrat who showed up was the ranking member who asked any questions. And they brought along some absurd woman historian who knew nothing about it, just to denigrate the proceedings as some kind of grotesque spectacle or whatever she said it was. You know, that's kind of embarrassing, but now that guy has been promoted to the ranking member of the Oversight Committee because the Democrat guy died. So that guy got bumped up because he's, you know, probably the most senior or most sensible. And he's been replaced by, probably in order of seniority, he's been replaced by Jasmine Crockett, who, believe it or not, Dealey Plaza is in her constituency. She's a Dallas representative, Congress. And she was the worst. In the first hearing, she was the absolute worst in terms of the things she said, the way she was demeaning and putting down the witnesses and saying this is all a waste of time and all the rest of it. I mean, it was appalling. And this person is now going to be sitting next to Luna in the next hearing. I mean, it's not ideal, but, you know, we'll just, I don't know, maybe they, I don't know how she got on anyway, but maybe they could block that. I mean, I don't know what.
Well, that's why
it's
up to, you know, researchers, interested citizens like yourself and other people in the community to say, in spite of these people, we're going to go forward with research.
Yeah. And as I said before, I mean, it is still really, really interesting. And there's always stuff that you can find in the archives. You start off online, you start with Mary Fail and say, that's something I'm really interested in. Just keep reading about it and then find, because the people who say, by the people you mentioned, and I know lots of them, say, yeah, I always wanted to find out what the truth was, but they're not, most of them are not going to do anything about it. So, I mean, you know, God love them. People are smart and they're not going to fall for that nonsense, but they're also not going to, the JFK assassination is going to remain that kind of American historical phenomenon that if it ever does appear in a headline, a person will be drinking their coffee in the morning and they might raise an eyebrow as they catch the headline, and they might read a couple of paragraphs and they might even read the whole thing. They will not stop what they're doing and devote the rest of their lives to finding out what it is. And that is a peculiar kind of social mistrust that just kind of endures and makes us a kind of a weird sort of society. And you could pick any number of issues. There are other issues out there that you could do. And I heard that there was going to be a hearing on RFK, that the task force was going to, and they hadn't scheduled an exact date, but it was supposed to be for September. I don't know whether that's going to happen now. Everything's been sort of overtaken by the grotesque Epstein thing. But they have seven issues that they're supposed to do. JFK was the first, and it's still going. So we could have another hearing on JFK, depending on. I think they should subpoena Mike Pompeo to find out why he really postponed the thing, because he said it was to protect people who are still alive. Well, we've had like tens of thousands of documents released. Who were these people again? I mean, he was talking about it, like it was a really serious thing, and I think he lied. And then he
Oh, of
threatened
course.
future
What do
crimes.
you mean by protect? You mean
Yeah.
it's to protect our institutions of fraud against the
Right.
American people? Well, we're taking money out of your budget to fund our operations, which are meant to obfuscate you and keep you from the truth. How you like that?
It's bad. I mean, I do think things are changing. I try to stay positive. And as I say, it's still interesting. And thank you for having all these experts on your show to talk about all these different things. I mean, you've had people on who've been doing this for decades, who've written all these books and done all these things and really done some serious discoveries. And I think that's great. I mean, I follow in their footsteps, and I learn from them, and they, as a new, relative newbie, I can look at all the things that all these people have done, and I have the luxury of taking what I think from each of them, what I think is most compelling and credible, and forming my own sort of view of it. And it's great to hear from them, and some of them are really brilliant writers and everything. So and they're all sidelined in this current is society. They don't get big publishing deals. That's this lie that there's some kind of big cottage conspiracy industry where people make all this money and get these. No, they don't get big book deals. They have to, Skyhorse might publish something of theirs because Skyhorse is that kind of alternative avenue, and
Or
they
Trine
do.
Day.
Right, or Trinday, and I mean, there's a few others. I think Regnery is a subsidiary of Skyhorse, but I mean, I look at my own library, and it's just not major publishers. I remember Jim Mars used to have bestsellers, and he did one big book on JFK, but he was sort of an exception. I mean, I'm sorry that he sort of he left us, I think, in an untimely way. But there's been a lot of self-publication. John Newman is, I mean, that stuff is really, really pretty
Grodin.
relevant, pretty great. Yeah, I mean, it's not been an easy ride for most of the JFK assassination research community, and people that do great work and aren't really rewarded. And that's a symptom of the mutation of American
Oh,
society.
well, thank goodness for the internet that we can
Yeah.
network and connect like this at the mainstream, with the thanks of like Tucker Carlson and Joe Rogan and that people, they're having people on that are saying, no, what you're saying is lying. And if you believe it, fine. But to the listeners and all the people that tune into Black Op Radio and other shows and that, now we realize how we've been lied to. Okay, well, Chad, please send me links. I'll get in touch with you via email and we'll make the show notes with the proper links to everything that you discuss so people can go further. A lot of times people are driving or hiking or doing something, listening to the show, and they get home, they go, I want to see that document. I want to see where is his Substack? Where is this, right?
You bet, you bet. Yeah, excellent, Glenn. I'll definitely do that. I'll send you a bunch of links, and I can send you the link to my own, just my Substack page. It lists all my writing, both on JFK Facts and my
Perfect.
personal Substack. And yeah, and one last thing, I mean, I communicated with Jim DiEugenio briefly by email. I suggested, listen, can in light of all the recent discoveries, instead of doing the JFK annual conferences in Dallas every year, Dallas is not really a very nice city, especially the area where they always hold the conference. Why can't we do one in New Orleans? The weather is perfect in November. The food is really amazing. It's a really interesting city, and it's really important to the assassination. And he was like, that's a really good idea, but it's too late this year. But maybe we could do a co-sponsorship, JFK Facts, and Kennedy's and King or something sometime. And I think that I just contacted him because I thought he probably had some clout in this, but they arrange these things ahead of time. But they're going to totally online, which, as you say, thank God for the internet. People can tune in and follow along with things. But that's one thing I think we should really think about is having a JFK conference in New Orleans one of these years.
Well, I thought I had one better, which was to make it a holiday, so you would go out in the daytime with your family and stuff, and then have a week long of lectures. And I think it was in 2010. I had
That's
planned,
great.
it was in Waikiki, Hawaii.
Oh, that's a great idea. And
And
by the way, there's a very important conference in Honolulu on the 20th of November. So we covered that in the countdown series, like 2 days before the assassination. LBJ was there talking, and people like Colby, senior, like CIA people talking about Vietnam 2 days before the assassination. I mean, what the hell? So that's.
Oh, we should talk about that more. Sorry, I brought it up so late. But I'm saying in 2010, because John, I had a few people there, but I ran into some struggles that as a novice setting up a conference, I learned about. And if I had to do it again, then I'd, okay, don't do this, don't do that. And now this is what you do, right? But John Armstrong is there, right?
Oh, yes, he
We
is
had
there.
Wes Warrington, Mark DeVolk, from the UK. I mean, a lot of people said, this is great. I would like to go to the beach every day and then a week long and evenings,
That would be awesome. That would be great. Yeah, I'd love
But
to do that.
you have to have somebody who's just, which I learned, who's good at setting up conferences. It doesn't matter the topic at all, to set up the conference and get the airlines and the hotels and all this and that. What did I have going on there? Anyway, another topic. But okay,
Yeah.
thank you very much for sharing your time today.
You
And it's been
bet.
a pleasure speaking to you, and keep up the good work.
Pleasure's all mine, Lynn. Thanks again very much.
You're very welcome.
Okay, bye.